You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. I can see we've given up all pretense of objectivity here with that.
This is just to annoy you. These are my head games.
It's literally and figuratively working. So cool. Yeah. For those listening at home, he's sporting a Biden Harris baseball cap. So
I mean, this is half to annoy you and half because my hair is a complete disaster today.
I think we are depriving the audience from the opportunity to criticize our hair.
I mean, I think they've all seen how far gone we've become. Now I'm getting my second dose tomorrow. In 2 weeks, I'll be fully vaccinated.
By the way, today's my 2 week anniversary.
Oh, so you're fully vaccinated as of today.
I think today I'm totally in the clear. I'm going to go do something really dangerous.
Get your hair cut?
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't want to deprive the audience from, let's be honest, a big part of this show has become commenting on our appearance.
So this is the question. Should we get our hair cut once you're vaccinated, or have we found the look that really works for us?
Well, I feel like I've gone too far to go back. I think I went through the worst parts of the in-between parts. Not that I'm Samson or anything like that. But I have to say, you remember when Al Gore lost the election and he grew that beard and got a little bit fat for a while?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
I think I'm going through, I don't want to call it a midlife crisis, but like, you know, I moved out to the country and I'm no longer a CNN contributor. Those jobs are only for people like Rick Santorum. So I think growing the hair out is sort of a big middle finger to the man. So I'm doing it.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, How about you? What's your excuse? Are you going to get a hair? I offered you, by the way, the chance, Bill, I offered you the chance to do something for charity and to shave your head.
Yeah, that will never happen.
And you refuse to do it for the children.
Yeah, no matter how much the children suffer, that's the one line I'm not going to cross.
What if I held a gun to a puppy?
So, that's on you. I'm not going to take responsibility for your cruel acts. Yes, I mean, I do think that. I mean, we should probably not talk about our hair for too much longer.
I think this is more interesting than anything else you have to say.
It probably should get cut back to some extent, but I'll probably leave it longer than where I had it.
Yeah, damn the man.
Anyway, Liz Cheney, were you expecting, 4 years ago, that the person who would arguably take the most personal risk for their career to stand up to Donald Trump would be Liz Cheney?
No, I didn't like Liz Cheney. I felt like she was someone, obviously the product of nepotism, born on third base. I didn't like the fact that she like tried to Bigfoot whoever the U.S. senator used to be or is. It's unclear.
In
Wyoming. Who was it?
That's not senator, congressperson. I forget who she was up against in that race.
No. She moved to Wyoming.
Right.
And tried to muscle out the senator.
Or right? Enzi. She wanted to push out Enzi, right?
Okay. And it's almost like, the Godfather moving in on Vegas, but she didn't pull it off the way Michael Corleone did. I felt like that was a bit presumptuous to think you can up and move back to a state and then muscle out the senator. So yeah, I was not a fan, but, one thing I've learned is that, well, a couple things. One is that Trump has scrambled everything. And forced because of Trump, he has exposed the people's character. And the other thing is that it's unpredictable almost which people were going to display courage and heroism and those are few and far between, in which people were going to pander and sell out. And I mean, like, okay, if you had said like 5 years ago, like Elise Stefanik or Liz Cheney go, I don't know that I would have been able to, which one's the heel and which one's the face. You know what I'm saying? But it's been very, I mean, Trump has been clarifying in that regard.
Yes, you know, I'm refreshing my memory as we talk. I just jumped onto the Liz Cheney Wikipedia page that talked about, you know, she had announced her run against Enzi and then withdrew. But in her first campaign appearance, this is 2014, she said, "We have to not be afraid of being called obstructionists. Obstructing President Obama's policies and his agenda isn't actually obstruction, it's patriotism." So that's where she started.
Yeah.
And now she's going down in large part because she had the temerity of giving Joe Biden a fist bump.
Well, I think amazingly that's pretty low on the list of reasons they're taking her down.
But that's what regenerated all this chatter.
I think it was the Robert Draper expose that really, I mean, this thing's been bubbling for a while, but I think it was more the Robert Draper expose, which, remember the quotes about her being like the girlfriend in the stands who's rooting for the other team. I think that pissed off Republicans, that profile. And then I think Trump has reemerged a little bit on the scene, reiterating his big lie, and that prompted Liz to speak out or be asked about it.
Well, she keeps doubling and tripling and quadrupling down, but I mean,
but it's not that, I don't think it was, my opinion, the fist bump is probably not getting, I mean, if I were trying to take her down, I think I would have made a bigger deal out of it than Republicans actually did.
I just think she had been kind of forgotten about, it was kind of behind her, and then the fist bump happened, all of a sudden it's Liz Cheney in the news all the time.
No, that's not my perception of the last couple of weeks, but maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, but you might be following closer than I have. But she clearly is trying to indicate that it's okay to talk politely to a Democrat when that wasn't her stance in her entry into elective politics.
That's true, but I don't think that is the reason.
The bigger thing is that she's not accepting the big lie. I mean, I get that. Do we have a sense of what if she has an end game? She must know that by poking this bear repeatedly, loudly, means that she will lose her leadership slot, that she wouldn't win a primary in 2022. She must not care. But is it that, you know, I'm just going to go out in a blaze of glory, or I'm going to run for president in 2024. I'm going to start a third party. I'm going to start a new organization. I'm going to be a CNN pundit. Do we have any idea what her end game is?
I don't have any idea. Well, I have theories. And so I don't think it's the last thing you just described, because she could always become a talking head. I mean, she was like on Fox News Special Report. She was one of the all-stars or whatever they called them on Bret Baier. She was on almost every night on Special Report. So she left that. And I would argue that perch she had was bigger than if she became a CNN pundit or something. So I don't think that this is like a weird bank shot to go into punditry. She had that. She was doing it at a very high level. I don't think she's the type of person who prioritizes being on TV over being in a powerful, relevant position. So that one doesn't make sense to me. I think there are two theories that are not mutually exclusive that I would think of. One is I think it's actually possible that she is a principled person in this regard, and that she's willing to do the right thing and damn the consequences. I also think that she may be doing what almost nobody does anymore, which is making a long-term bet, which is to say, I am willing to take the slings and arrows, and it may be a few years, but I have faith that by doing the right thing, I will ultimately win and ultimately be rewarded. And if you think of it, if you want to think about a niche, there are a lot of people occupying the niche of Trump sycophant and Trump supporter. And when the 2024 presidential race, if Trump doesn't run, there's going to be a whole field of people competing to be the next Trump or like Trump. And there's also a pretty big niche, pretty big space full of people who've tried to kind of have it both ways. You know, the Dan Crenshaws of the world, the people who like sometimes might criticize Trump, but they're not going to go too far with it. And they're trying to play this little game. And, you know, it's not maybe not as occupied as the Trumpy sycophant space, but there are a lot of people in it. But there's nobody. What Liz Cheney is staking out is a turf she will own. I mean, I should have thrown Ben Sasse in the category of people who are sort of trying to have it both ways. And Nikki Haley has kind of been in that space too. Liz Cheney is going to own the space of being the one person who was tough and courageous. Because, see, keep in mind, people like Jeff Flake and John Kasich, they do not come across as tough. Now, I'm not saying that they're not. I'm not questioning like their manhood or anything like that. I'm just saying temperamentally, they don't come across as tough. Liz Cheney, partly I think because she's a woman and has a unique way of going after Trump, and partly because she's Dick Cheney's daughter, is tough and is going after him in a very strong way. So I'll shut up here when I just finish this point, which is she may be making a long-term bet that ultimately she's going to stake out this point and that doing right will ultimately be rewarded someday.
So to put a finer point on what you're saying, do you think this is a play not for 2024, but maybe for 2028?
Yeah. If to the degree that this, and I don't want to dismiss or take away the potential that this is also like literally heroic and principled, but to the degree that this is a strategic move, I cannot see this working in the near term. I think that this is a big bet, and it's a long-term bet. And I don't think it's absurd. I mean, think of it, Bill. It wasn't that long ago, really, that George W. Bush and compassionate conservatism dominated the conservative movement and the Republican Party. And that if you got crosswise of Karl Rove, you were in the doghouse, okay? And then, you know, a few years later, Trump basically goes the complete opposite direction, takes down Jeb Bush, talks about the Iraq War, yada, yada, yada. So it's not absurd to me to think that at some point, the pendulum will swing back and the public will go looking for a tough, non-Trump Republican. I don't see it happening anytime in the near term. But I think it's within the realm of possibility that that pendulum swings. And when it does, nobody will have a better claim to that mantle than Liz Cheney.
Yeah, so Liz Cheney may well get replaced by Elise Stefanik, who, according to the American Conservative Union, has a weaker rating than Liz Cheney on actual votes on issues.
Yeah. And the Club for Growth doesn't like either, but they put out a tweet saying that, you know, Elise Stefanik is no conservative or no fiscal conservative.
Right. I mean, Club for Growth is, you know, almost cute in thinking that conservative issue positions are what's driving this discussion. The whole takeaway from this is that fealty to Trump and the big lie and being positioned to wage culture war battles with Trump as the leader, take precedence over your position on, you know, tax cuts and deregulation, everything. Things of that nature.
Everything. Someone, I just saw a tweet that National Review had a column. So remember, when Trump I don't want to say Trump tweeted because he doesn't tweet, but Trump put out a statement calling Liz Cheney a warmonger.
He has a Tumblr now or something rather. He has a live journal.
Yeah, it's like a blog, basically. Welcome to the party. You're 20 years late, but great. So Trump called Liz Cheney a warmonger, and National Review has like a post up calling talking about, quote, warmonger Elise Stefanik, because she like was attacking Obama for wanting to withdraw from Afghanistan or something, you know?
You know, there's a piece I'm working on. I'm talking about this a little bit more in a little bit about the midterms and Democratic prospects for it. And so I'm going over the times when other President's party bucked the trend and gained seats. One of them is 2002. And I'm explaining, you know, after 9/11, there was a big push for national security and that benefited Republicans. I felt I needed to have a parenthesis for you younger readers.
Yes.
At this point in history, Republicans were considered the party stronger in national security. Because you can't, why if you were 25 years old, would you assume that the way
now? That's a valid point. I just saw someone, I have to verify this, but someone said on Twitter that for our kids, Seinfeld is as old as like Andy Griffith was for us. And that's a scary thought. And we, as we get older, Bill, we probably have to not assume things such as that were really conventional wisdom, right?
Well, you know, I come across the occasional tweet, you know, that 70s show started in 1998. And so if you did a similar show now, it'd be set in, you know, 2001.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that actually would be a good show. To do a period piece about post 9/11 America, being a teenager in that time, actually, that is like your Wonder Years show for the current time. It wouldn't be a ludicrous pitch.
Is it Back to the Future? Have we got to the point now where like more time has expired since 1985?
Yeah, we're past 30 years.
Right. I guess that's when the Chicago Cubs won the World Series. I'm not sure, but that's a weird thing, right? Because I remember in the 80s, because I went to see that at the theaters. I have a lot of fond memories of seeing. I've seen a lot of great movies at the movies. I like literally went, and I remember my mom took me to see Back to the Future, and in 1985, 1955 seems so different. Mm-hmm. Mr. Sandman was playing. It's so out of touch. And I don't think if you were to do that today, if you were to go back to 1985, I don't think it would seem so long ago or so out of touch, but maybe it would to a young person.
I mean, I think, you know, Vietnam and the baby and what happened in the 60s was such a paradigm shift
big time.
You could do those sorts of, period pieces, and it would seem very, very long ago.
Even just if you just watch the Brady Bunch, like the first season of the Brady Bunch,
I'm actually going through the Brady Bunch in order now with my younger daughter, who has strangely become interested in it. And
so, just 5 years, if you like the way they were dressed and their hair looked when the show debuted versus 5 years later, it's like 20 years pass.
You know, they're close together is the episode where Greg goes all hippie and and, you know, gets his own room briefly with the lava lamps and the psychedelic, you know, lights and everything. And then like the next episode, Marsha gets into women's lib and Greg becomes this raging sexist and is trying to thwart her entry into his Frontier Scouts at every turn. So that aside.
Wait, this is more interesting than anything else we've got to say, but okay.
You know, I think I saw something about things being not that far away from, you know, 2001 area, but and I thought the whole Framing Britney Spears documentary. Do you see that?
Yeah, I saw it.
I mean, what's so startling about that is the way Britney Spears was treated is 180 degrees different than how she would be treated today. Not that like sexism is no more, but you would not see the kind of question she got thrown at her and the kind of treatment in the tabloids be replicated identically today because we're post Me Too. And I mean, that's why you could do stuff, period, in the 80s, in the 90s, in the aughts, in the 10s, and tease out the things that we don't do anymore to show how far we have traveled.
If we did a show today based in 2001 and the character in that show in 2001 acted or behaved in a way that we might have behaved back then, would the show be canceled or the actor be canceled today?
I mean,
for a realistic depiction of what it would have been like back then.
I mean, you can watch episodes of The Office and of 30 Rock and see jokes that landed then don't land the same way now. I don't think that means the shows are no longer watchable or anything like that. But the way certain issues about racism and sexism were treated on those shows, you would not be able to do those jokes the same way today because people's sensibilities have shifted. So there is all sorts of opportunities for period pieces that get into those sorts of issues.
Well, the iPhone, too. I mean, you're right. I think culturally that shift is race and sex has shifted. The iPhone, though, is I think the other big – I mean, how many – I wonder how many shows the plot would have been destroyed if somebody could have checked a text or the weather report or, you know, emailed somebody when they were lost at the airport or the mall. Like, I wonder how many shows would be destroyed if they had a GPS system or something, you know, on their phone. So
let me go back to the midterms. So we don't completely, you know, bore the hell out of everyone listening.
What we should do is give up the DM Zoom and just do a patrons only show where the only rule is you can't talk politics. And every time I try to get you to talk about weird stuff, you quit segueing back to the news. I would pay to watch that.
So I don't know if you saw yesterday, Steny Hoyer gave an interview with Washington Post Karen Tumulty, and he was asked, yeah, how you feel about 2022? You guys barely have a majority. President's party almost always loses seats in the midterm. You got redistricting issues. How you feel about 2022? And Hoyer's like, you know, I'm optimistic. I think, you know, there are exceptions to those rules. And the Republican Party is very divided right now. Trump's not on the ballot. I think we can do this. And, you know, the average political analyst is saying, you know, Nathan Gonzalez at Roll Call had a column where he said, if Republicans can't win the House, like they should go out of business because this is just, you know, teed up for them. And so the piece that I'm working on right now argues that Hoyer has a point. Now, you know, Hoyer, I think you speak a little extemporaneously, so perhaps I'm being a little unfair to dig him on this. But he was like, you know, there are exceptions when we're in deep economic downturns. And I'm like, that's not where the exceptions are. You know, deep economic downturn is terrible for a president's party. Recession of 82, sluggish recovery in 2010. There's actually the recession of 38 was terrible for FDR. There was a recession of 58 that was bad for Eisenhower's Republicans. The examples where the president's party bucks the trend, and mind you, how common this is, every midterm from Reconstruction, the president party loses seats, but for three times. You're 36 midterms, three times the president party bucks trend.
One was 2002.
2002, as we mentioned earlier. 98.
But Republicans, Bill Clinton's president, right?
Yep.
Okay. And that is that the bucking of the trend, is that part of what pushed Newt out?
Right. That's right.
Okay.
And the other one is 34 when FDR's first midterm. There's a fourth I'm going to add here. The one time the president party lost seats, but it was fewer than five seats. And that is 62.
In 98, did Democrats didn't gain. They just lost.
They gained.
Did they really?
They gained five seats in the House.
Okay. Wow. That's underrated. This was a backlash against impeachment?
Exactly right. But I mentioned 62 because Republicans need five seats. So if Democrats could actually keep it below five seats, they would hang on. So I got four examples where it's either gaining seats or less than five loss. 1934, FDR is elected in the midst of the Great Depression. New Deal is kicking in. People feel like the ship's turning around. President's Party gets credit. 62, you're a month after the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was a 13-point boost for JFK. 98, manufactured impeachment crisis. Republicans had just authorized the impeachment inquiry while the economy was booming. The median voter's like, what are you doing, Republicans? Leave Bill Clinton alone. Things are going fine. This is insane. And then 2002, post 9/11, national security fervor. Republicans are the party of strength. Bush right. and the Republicans reap the benefit.
So
the common theme in all of these is crisis.
Yes. And was Donald Trump 9/11? Was he? Because that's the only thing I could think of, right? It's not the economy. I mean, COVID, it's probably not COVID. To me, if there is an exception this time, it has to be stop Donald Trump, right?
Well, I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, we're in the middle of a crisis.
So you think that we're not in the middle. We're not in the middle. We're not going to be in the middle. We're not going to be in the middle in November.
That's the unknown here. That is the unknown. It may well be that the crisis is over and that we've moved on to other things to complain about. And so the Democrats don't get a bump out of it. Or it could be that the variants are still circling. Okay. We haven't reached herd immunity. We need boosters.
If it happens, if Democrats defy history, it won't be because the economy is bad or something. If it happens, it will be because COVID is still a serious existential sort of threat.
I think it's hard to gauge exactly. I mean, at minimum, Biden entered into office during a crisis, and it may be that he gets the credit for dealing with it, and that carries over into 2022. Or we're still in the middle of the crisis, and Biden's getting credit for navigating it the best he can. Or we're in the middle of it, and Biden's not getting credit for it because his expectations were too high, and he's getting judged on a double standard. So is he going to get judged on the double standard that doesn't behoove him, or is he going to get judged on the Trump standard? Hey, at least you're better than that guy.
Yes.
And look, there are times when Democrats...
I'm familiar with that standard. Every time I write a piece that criticizes something Joe Biden's doing, I'm reminded of that standard.
Look, in 1990, this was... I'm trying to remember my chronology correctly. I believe this is after Gulf War. This is after Gulf War, though they're moving forward on the Bush tax cut, on the Bush tax hike. That's not signed until after the midterm. I think the train is already leaving the station. But so the Bush approval is still very high because of the war. And Republicans only lose eight seats. So it's still pretty good, historically speaking, but that wouldn't be good enough for Biden and the Democrats today.
Yeah.
So he may be given points for handling the pandemic. The economy may be in relatively good shape and still not might be good enough.
Right. But the other, I would say, I agree. Look, so I'm just going to play devil's advocate here because I agree that, you know, all the trends would predict that Republicans will have a very good midterm. But there's never been I don't think there's ever been a political party so bereft of ideas. So
Republicans.
The current Republicans are so lacking of any coherent philosophy other than we are against the left and we are for Trump. I mean, so that would, it's hard to compare the current Republican Party to any other out party historically, right?
I think that's probably fair. And I think it is relevant because, you know, why is it that the president's party usually loses seats? Usually by 2 years in, you're dealing with governing realities. Everything has not become magically better upon the president's election. Either you're making compromises that are deflating your base, or you're hitting gridlock, and you're not getting stuff done. And so your base is deflated, the opposition base is motivated, and the swing voters are swinging away from you. I mean, that is the normal course of events.
And the out party usually develops a coherent argument against the incumbent and gets their act together, probably.
I mean, it's easier to organize against a common enemy. And so the president's party is not being judged against the other party. It's being judged against itself and is often found wanting because things aren't perfect. So will we be in a different place in 2022 where the Democrats remain unified because Biden is getting some things done, and the Republican Party remains in disarray because they're still bedeviled about what to do about Trump? And so right. Even though in the House, I mean, this is why I think why even talking about this? Why should we be gaming this out like it's a, you know, like we're sports handicappers? Because I think it's relevant to how Democrats should be deciding on legislative strategy. The name of the game has to be unifying your party and dividing the other party. That's how you win elections. And so how do you get there with your own legislative strategy? The House, as we just talked about, seems to be wholly disinterested in conservative principles. They just want to be, you know, Trumpist culture warriors, and they're willing to throw conservative leaders over the side if they don't follow that regimen. The Senate is not like that as much. The Senate has these either actual moderates or faux moderates, depending on your perspective. There are the Romneys, there are the Capitos, there are the Susan Collins. And so the question becomes, are Democrats better off with more rescue plans that circumvent Republicans, go big, deliver for the public, popular things that make everybody happy? Or if those types of opportunities are not readily available going forward, are they better off striking those compromises because that further divides the Republican Party?
Yeah.
Does that keep the Trumpers home because they're mad that the Romneys and the Capitos are working with Biden and the Democrats, to the extent they're not thrilled that things got watered down, they're still happy things got done and things look better than they were in the Trump days? That's not an easy question to solve because you can't know which is the right answer until you pick a lane.
Yeah.
But
I think they've made their bet, though, and it may not even be the bet as to which of those alternatives helps them keep the majority. It may be a tacit acceptance that they're going to lose the majority, which would force you to.
Well, that's another calculation. People might say there's no way we're going to win. Therefore, you know, damn their torpedoes.
Yeah, you've got like a year and a half to do this and go big, and nothing's going to happen. You're going to get nothing done after 20.
And then maybe you'll be rewarded for what you get done. Maybe not right away, but you get rewarded in 2024.
Yep. I think that's the calculation. I just want to go back real quick to why this historical precedent may be flawed. And I think I touched on this, but just to make it explicit, I think part of what happens is out parties also become liberated, and they become innovative, and they become entrepreneurial. And that can't happen if Donald Trump is still there. Like, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is a lot of times these out parties benefit. They're freed and liberated to come up with solutions and ideas. And I mean, I think that's true, but it can't happen if Trump is on the scene. So Trump is preventing that. And I think that's one of the reasons that Liz Cheney is taking her stand, is because she understands that we have to get rid of Donald Trump if we are going to move forward.
And I arguably it's a mistake that Mitch McConnell made not rallying his folks for impeachment, conviction, and disqualification from running for future office. Rip off that Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Take the short-term hits so the party can truly move on, knowing that Trump will never be on the ballot again. They didn't take that opportunity, and now you're stuck.
He's playing a different – McConnell's playing like a different long game, which is the name of his book. I think it's an unwise game, but it's just like, you know, outweigh him, outlast him, keep, you know, just sort of stay in the game. I think that they should have been more radical in getting rid of Trump. I think that they should have said, like, this is going to be real painful when we pull this Band-Aid off, and it's going to suck, but we got to do it now. And they never did it.
Nope.
And here we are.
I want to go back to the Democrats, though, because you think that they've made their bet that they're going to stay partisan.
Absolutely.
They're going to go big and stay partisan. And I think it's more complicated than that. And so I had a different piece at the Monthly that ran earlier in the week, which point out that we've had no filibusters in the first 100 days. And still, now we've had no filibusters. The Senate has passed 13 bills. Biden signed 10 of them into law. I think the other three are going to get to his desk eventually. And
I think I quoted you in my Daily Beast piece.
I believe you did. I think a lot of Jim Garrity of the National Review was quoting me too. It's every conservative's favorite piece now. but it's not simply to say Republicans are wonderful people who aren't filibustering. Like that's not the takeaway.
Even liberal Bill Scheer acknowledges.
But you should acknowledge plain facts. You know, these bills, not only do these bills pass, but only two of them were partisan. There's the rescue plan, and there's the Congressional Review Act, which was a taking away of a Trump deregulation thing. And there's a law called the Congressional Review Act, which circumvents filibusters. Got a couple of Republicans on that one, though, but it wasn't 60. The other ones, not only did they pass, McConnell voted for them. And these are things that are, there's the $35 billion water infrastructure bill, there's extension of PPP, there's the suspension of Medicare cuts, there's the waiver for Lloyd Austin. I mean, these aren't big bills. These aren't transformational bills. These aren't top of the Democratic agenda bills. But if the game plan is make Democrats miserable, make it impossible for them to govern, make everything dysfunctional because the blame will rest on their shoulders, we won't get the blame. If that was the plan, you let the Medicare cuts go through. You don't let him get his guy for the Pentagon. You let the small business go under PPP. The Republicans did not do that, not because they're wonderful people, because they thought they would get blamed for it. They didn't think it was so simple that the blame could be shifted. And now the other side of this is, why aren't Democrats instigating filibusters? Why isn't H.R. 1 on the floor of the Senate already? Why isn't the PRO Act? Why isn't the gun background check bill? Schumer's biding his time on all of these things, while Biden is saying to Republicans, let's talk about infrastructure. So both parties are worried about being blamed for obstruction. If Schumer thought it was in their interest to instigate that filibuster and blame Republicans for it, he would do it. But a lot of those bills don't have 50 votes. D.C. statehood does not have 50 votes. Labor rights does not have 50 votes. Gun background checks does not have 50 votes. They would look like they didn't have their act together. and they were not doing what they promised to do, which is work across the aisle. So, I mean, it's certainly possible, Matt.
I love it when you get passionate like this.
It's possible that they'll hit those brick walls and infrastructure and they'll eventually go reconciliation. I can't predict that. But they're not there today. And so I think there's a great deal of uncertainty where this all goes from here. You know, there may be plenty of Democrats who think the right game plan is to go big and to go partisan, but they don't have their ducks lined up for it right now. So the Manchins of the world may get to decide not just what's up with these individual bills, but what is the entire strategy for 2022? Because the two things are intertwined.
You had me. That was passionate. I love that. I think maybe we end it there, right?
We certainly can. Anything else that you need to plug?
I did a podcast interview with I guess he was the top scientist at Obama's Department of Energy.
The top scientist?
Think so. He was like the undersecretary. Are you questioning this man's credentials?
I saw you plug this, and it definitely raised an eyebrow with me what the backstory is here. But continue.
Okay, the book is called Unsettled, and we did a podcast, and nobody's denying that the Earth is warming, Bill, but he says the science is not incontrovertible. So interesting.
So, and this is, I am curious more about this gentleman's backstory.
Well, if you find something, let me know. But he seems legit.
Considering that the Obama administration was pretty serious about climate change, and the Biden team even arguably more so.
This is a well-credentialed science. I think he's at NYU now. I think he was at USC. Or Palo Alto or whatever that is out there where Richard Feynman was, I think Big Bang Theory. anyway, and this is a guy who, you know, unless he's completely lying to not just me, but the Wall Street Journal and every other outlet, you know, was in the Obama administration.
Oh, he's in the administration, and he believes what he believes. I'm curious if there's more to his story.
Well,
he clearly wasn't determining Obama's climate policy.
Clearly not. But I think I don't want to get bogged down in this, but I think that some of his reservations have emerged in the last decade. So that would have been, you know, after he served in the Obama administration, because I think he served the first couple of years.
Got it. OK. Look, Mike Flynn was in Obama's administration. So, you know,
there you go.
Some crazy characters got in there some way, somehow.
Well, I don't want to put this guy who seems fine to me in the same class with Mike Flynn, but I will. You know, that's obviously the case. In every administration. So,
always going to talk to you, Matt.
I would challenge people to check out the podcast and decide for themselves.
I'll talk to you tomorrow on the Zoom. We just have to make sure it is before my shot. I'm not going to throw in my shot for the Zoom.
Or we could live cast that as well. and if you want to see Bill get his shot, and you want to see what liberal tears really look like, you could go to patreon.com/BillShare or /MattLewis and wet our beaks a little bit, help support this sort of fine content that we do, and you can be a part of that.
All right. I'll talk to you tomorrow on the Zoom and then back here in the DMZ next week.
Have a good one.
Take care.